The organizations that survive the next decade won't be the ones that automated the most. They'll be the ones that figured out what to stop delegating. There's a prevailing fantasy right now, call it the delegation dream, where every task that can be handed off should be handed off, to a junior, to a contractor, to a machine. The logic feels airtight. If someone or something else can do it, why would you? Free up the senior people for higher order thinking. Let the specialists specialize. Let the machines machine. But here's what nobody talks about. Delegation without comprehension is just prayer. You're trusting that the outcome will be right because you set up the conditions to be right. And every layer of delegation adds a layer of opacity between the person who cares about the outcome and the person or thing producing it. This works fine when the task is truly mechanical. Nobody needs to understand the postal system to mail a letter. But knowledge work isn't like mailing a letter. Knowledge work is fractal. The details contain decisions, and the decisions contain values, and the values are the whole point. When you delegate the details, you're often delegating the decisions you didn't realize were embedded in them. Every fast-growing company hits a moment, usually around 50 people, where the CEO stops being able to hold the whole operation in their head. They can't track every project, every customer, every hire. So they build systems, dashboards, status reports, stand-ups, one-on-ones, all designed to give them a compressed representation of reality. The problem is that compression is lossy. The dashboard shows green, but green means nobody reported a problem, not there are no problems. The status report says on track, which means the person writing it either genuinely believes it or doesn't want to be the one to say otherwise. The one-on-one covers what the direct report thinks is important, which is not necessarily what's actually important. Every leader knows this. The good ones develop workarounds, walking the floor, reading the raw data, asking unexpected questions to people three levels down. They're fighting the compression. They're trying to reconstruct the reality that their own reporting systems have smoothed away. But here's the question nobody asks. What if the compression itself is the wrong approach? What if instead of summarizing reality for the leader, you made reality directly inspectable? Not through dashboards that abstract, but through systems transparent enough that looking at them is understanding them. Silence is the most expensive failure mode in any organization. Not crashes, not outages, not the dramatic, visible disasters that mobilize response teams. Silence, the thing that doesn't report back, the process that swallows its error, the employee who stops raising concerns because raising concerns didn't change anything last time. A hospital that has zero reports isn't safe. It has a reporting problem. A restaurant kitchen that never sends food back isn't excellent. It has a feedback loop that's been severed somewhere between the dining room and the pass. A company where nobody pushes back in meetings isn't aligned. It's afraid. The cost of silence compounds in a way that nothing else does. A visible failure gets fixed. A loud complaint gets addressed, but a silent failure just continues. It becomes the baseline. People route around it. They develop workarounds for the workarounds. After enough time, nobody remembers that the original thing was supposed to work in the first place. The organizations that break this pattern aren't the ones that demand transparency. Demanding transparency just teaches people what you want to hear. The ones that break it are the ones that make honesty cheaper than silence. When it's easier to say this is broken than to work around it, people say it's broken. When filing a complaint takes less effort than ignoring the problem, people file complaints. When reporting a near miss is less painful than hoping nobody noticed, near misses get reported. This sounds obvious, but look at what most organizations actually do. They build elaborate escalation procedures. They require justifications for exceptions. They make the person who found the problem responsible for also proposing the solution. Every one of these mechanisms increases the cost of honesty. They were designed to prevent noise, and they succeeded, along with the signal. There's a specific kind of arrogance that comes from being the person who built something. You understand it so deeply that you can't imagine anyone else understanding it. So you write the documentation not as a map, but as a monument. Every decision recorded, every trade-off explained, every alternative considered and rejected. The documentation becomes a portrait of your thinking, and maintaining it becomes an act of self-preservation. This is how you end up with a 2 million character file that was supposed to help people navigate a codebase. 2 million characters. That's longer than War and Peace. It was written with the best of intentions by someone who genuinely wanted to help. And it was completely useless, because nobody was ever going to read it, and the person who wrote it was too close to it to see that. The instinct to document everything comes from a good place. Fear of loss. If I don't write it down, it'll be forgotten. If it's forgotten, we'll make the same mistakes again. If we make the same mistakes, we'll waste time. So document everything. But documentation that nobody reads is worse than no documentation, because it creates the illusion of preserved knowledge. People point to it. It's in the docs. They don't check. They don't need to. The existence of the docs is itself reassuring. The organization sleeps well knowing that someone, somewhere, wrote it all down. Meanwhile, the actual knowledge is in three people's heads, and two of them left last quarter. The most interesting thing happening in how AI changes organizations isn't what AI can do. It's what AI reveals about what humans were already doing badly. When you give a machine a task that a human used to do, and the machine does it in 90 seconds, the natural reaction is, wow, the machine is fast. The more interesting reaction is, why was a human spending 45 minutes on that? Not because the human was slow, because the task was never examined. It was just part of someone's job. It accumulated there the way barnacles accumulate on a hull, gradually, invisibly, until the ship is dragging more weight than it's carrying. Every organization is full of barnacle tasks. Not the big ones. Those get noticed and optimized. The small ones, the 15-minute setup ritual before the real work starts, the weekly report that four people produce and nobody reads, the approval step that exists because someone misused their authority in 2019, and the policy was never revisited. AI doesn't create the problem of barnacle tasks. AI makes them visible for the first time. When you try to hand a task to a machine and discover that the task doesn't make sense, that it requires judgment calls, the machine can't make, because the task was never designed, it just accreted, you've learned something about your organization that no consultant could have told you. The companies that use AI well won't be the ones that automate the most tasks. They'll be the ones that use the automation attempt as an audit. We tried to automate this and couldn't. Why? Because it's actually three different tasks masquerading as one, and the middle one requires taste. That's valuable information. That's the kind of information that restructures teams and rethinks job descriptions. The companies that use AI badly will do what they've always done with new tools, bolt it onto the existing process without questioning the process. The 45-minute task becomes a 90-second task, and everyone celebrates, and nobody asks why the task exists. There's a reason military operations converge on a specific pattern: brief, execute, debrief. Not brief, execute, 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 debrief whenever we get around to it. Brief, execute, debrief. Every time. The debrief isn't optional, and it isn't a luxury. It's where the learning happens. Most organizations treat the debrief, the retrospective, the postmortem, the lessons learned, as a special event, something you do after a big failure or a major launch. The rest of the time, you just keep going. The assumption is that normal operations don't need reflection. That routine work doesn't generate lessons. This is backwards. Routine work generates the most important lessons, precisely because it's routine. The patterns you don't notice are the ones running the show. The habits you never examine are the ones shaping every outcome. The decisions you make on autopilot are the ones that define your culture. An organization that only reflects after crises will only learn from crises. And crisis lessons are the wrong lessons. They're dramatic, they're emotional, they're memorable, and they're usually about the specific crisis rather than the systemic conditions that made the crisis possible. The real lessons are hiding in Tuesday. In the way things went fine, but could have gone better. In the small friction that everyone routes around. In the meeting that accomplished nothing, but nobody canceled. Here's a question I keep coming back to, and I don't have a clean answer for it. At what point does an organization's infrastructure, its systems, its processes, its documentation, its automation, Stop serving the people in it and start being served by them. There's a tipping point, and it's hard to see when you're in it. The process was built to help. People followed the process because it helped. Then the process grew. People started spending time maintaining the process. Then the process became mandatory. People started spending time complying with the process. At some point, the process is the job, and the actual work happens in the margins. Every organization swears this won't happen to them. And every organization is wrong, eventually. The question isn't whether your systems will become self-serving. The question is whether you'll notice when they do, and whether you'll have the courage to tear them down and build something lighter. Because the alternative is what most organizations choose. Add another system on top of the one that stopped working, and hope the new one compensates for the old one's failures. Layer upon layer, each one rational in isolation, collectively absurd. The organizations that stay alive are the ones willing to periodically burn it all down and ask, if we were starting today, would we build this? And when the answer is no, which it usually is, they actually stop building it. Most don't. Most just add another layer. There's one more thing worth sitting with. The relationship between speed and quality has been a false dichotomy for so long that most people have stopped questioning it. Move fast and break things, versus measure twice, cut once. As if those are the only two options. As if velocity and care are on opposite ends of a slider. What if the actual variable isn't speed or care, but preparation? A surgeon who operates quickly isn't careless. They're prepared. They studied the scans, reviewed the patient history, discussed the approach with the team, rehearsed the tricky parts mentally. The operation itself is fast because the preparation was thorough. The speed is a consequence of readiness, not a substitute for it. The organizations that move fastest are not the ones that skip preparation. They're the ones that have figured out which preparation actually matters and automated the rest. The pre-flight checklist doesn't slow down the pilot. It's what allows the pilot to fly without second-guessing every switch. Most organizations confuse preparation with ceremony. The planning meeting that takes 2 hours isn't preparation, it's performance. The status update that everyone writes but nobody reads isn't preparation, it's bureaucratic muscle memory. The approval chain that adds 3 days isn't preparation, it's diffusion of responsibility. Real preparation is quiet. It happens before anyone's watching. It's the leader who reads the raw data before the meeting so they can ask the right questions. It's the team that runs the scenario before the launch so they know what failure looks like. It's the new hire who reads the actual customer complaints instead of the onboarding deck. When preparation is genuine, execution looks effortless. When preparation is theater, execution looks busy. And most organizations can't tell the difference. What would it take for yours to tell the difference?